I just dig that piece of blues music. I can listen to that over and over and over. Chris's Mississippi's with us tonight, but he's on a mission. You know, we were just having a conversation, you know, before the show, and I had mentioned the fact that I had forgotten to peel the can of Guinness open from my wife's black and tan a couple of days ago and just see what the hell a widget looks like. So Chris is on a mission. He's got the Google running, and I can see the smoke from here. So Chris is going to tell us what a widget is here in a little bit. But hey, welcome to the Meat House tonight. It is Tuesday night. We've got some sizer talk for you tonight. Chris, Mississippi Chris in the house, he's got a recipe that he thinks you might be interested in. We're going to talk a little bit about equipment investment versus convenience. How much do you spend and how much do you want to spend on your equipment? And is it really worth it? And can you get by with, you know, with some different things that are a little bit cheaper? We'll catch up on a few projects, Braggot, sizers, that kind of thing. In the meantime, we are listed on TuneIn Radio, so if you're listening for the first time and you're mobile, you can join us there. Just do a search, The Mead House. The show also replays on themeadhouse.com, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podcastpedia. So we are out there, folks. Just look for us, The Mead House. We're on Facebook. Again, simply The Mead House, and you know where we live. It's called themeadhouse.com. Call in number 818-921-4680. Feel free to call us anytime. Got a question, we'll be glad to help you out with it. In the house, Aaron Martin, Mississippi Chris Spencer, Jeff Schaus, Ryan Richardson joining us tonight. And, of course, my name is J.D. Webb. Did I leave anybody out? No?
Okay. All present.
All present and accounted for. Mississippi, what'd you find?
Yeah. Okay. We all know that nitrogen, the reason it gives it beer such a creamy head and carbonation, smooth carbonation, is because it's able to form smaller bubbles than carbon dioxide. Okay. So the head on the beer can be enhanced with agitation with more nitrogen. So when you get draft beer on tap that's nitrogenated, additional nitrogen is added at the spout, which creates a bigger and creamier head on the beer, like especially dark beers like Guinness. So the widget, what does it do? Well, oddly enough, what I'm finding here is that most of the beers that are carbonated with nitrogen, commercial beers, are done so with dry ice or liquid nitrogen. So they actually put liquid nitrogen into the can or bottle and then seal it. And then as it warms up, it tends to create pressure and carbonate the beer. The widget is basically just a small hollow device that has a very small hole in it, like a pinhole. And during the time in the can, this pressure pushes nitrogen and beer into the widget and pressurizes it. So when you open the can or bottle, it releases the pressure, and it allows the pressurized nitrogen and beer that's inside the widget to jet out of the little hole. That causes an agitation of the beer and bubble formation. So basically the whole purpose of the widget is to increase the head on the beer.
All that?
Yeah.
Why can't you just shake the can up?
That's what I do anyway. You can take two cans, shake them up, bang them together, and, you know, say, give me a hell yeah. You know?
Well, things are starting to make more sense to me. The last couple weeks, my wife and I have tried a couple nitrogenated beers, and she keeps telling me you need to open it and let it sit for like 10 or 15 seconds before you pour it. And I kept not understanding why, and I guess that's why. So the widget can do its work, and that agitation can happen, and you get that nice creamy head on there.
Ryan, I think, is the only one amongst us who does anything with nitrogen. Ryan, chime in here. What's the deal?
Yeah, you know, last week I was drinking a nitrogenated beer out of a can that did not have a widget in it, and then, you know, I really wasn't impressed with the carbonation that was coming out of it. It was not, to me, a true, you know, the way you'd expect one to be. And you know, then I had a Guinness later in the week, you know, which has the widget, and it was just poured perfect, you know, just the tiny bubbles, the creaminess, it felt, you know, a good mouthfeel. You know, I know that I've read that a lot of brewers are toying with how to, you know, how to put their nitrogen beers in cans. And I, you know, with that probably comes a lot of different testing and a lot of different ways to do it. And this one that I had last week while we were on the show that did not have a widget was, I don't think is the way to go. I think, you know, for any, commercial brewers out there toying with it, that widget, you know, is still the way to can anyway. Going back to what you said about on tap, you know, I do have a nitro keg set up. Now the keg is the same keg that you'd use for anything else. You need a nitrogen regulator. You know, obviously your nitrogen tank, and then you do need a special tap, a nitrogen tap that, as Chris is saying, puts that nitrogen on it right as you're pouring it out. So, you know, again, my experience is all in the kegging. And yes, you know, you definitely need a couple pieces of equipment. I mean, if you wanted to save space or save some money, you know, it's the same keg, and then you switch out the regulator and the tap if you're going for a regular carbonation or the nitrogen.
So the beer line, and there's actually two lines then going up to the single tap, right?
I've only got the one. I mean, I've got the line that goes in, you know, the regulator and the gas, and then there's no gas hookup to the tap. The tap is just a nitro tap.
So
I think some of those taps actually have some sort of mixer somewhere. There's got to be some place that the gas is mixed or something to agitate it.
Something, yeah.
I don't know. Ryan, do you use the same tap handle and spout that you use with CO2?
No, it is a different tap. It is a nitrogen tap. I haven't done much research on it, but I was told that you do need this special nitrogen tap to create that nitrogen head that you get with nitrogen, as opposed to your regular beer tap, you know, when it's regularly carbonated.
I've seen those.
I bet there's some sort of some sort of baffle or agitator or something inside there that probably agitates it.
That's what I'm thinking too, because I've seen those at Keg Connection. Haven't really paid much attention to them, but I know that they're, you know, when you go in to look at the different taps, they actually call them faucets. There's one particular one there for wine and one particular one for doing these stouts, you know, like Guinness for nitrogen. So I don't know what they do. You know, I haven't really looked into them that much. But so much on the nitrogen. That may be something that old JD here might do a little bit more research on as well. And, gosh, I just might have to buy a bigger refrigerator now. Damn it.
Okay, JD, before we move on, I've got a question for you guys. And this is going to show my total lack of knowledge for anything beer related. In the realm of dark beers such as Guinness and stouts and porters and things, what kind of beer would be like a Guinness, but it would have some more residual sweetness? Same basic beer, but just with more sweetness. What would I look for?
Stout, porter.
You know, I'll jump in there for a second. You know, within the stout family, there are several different types. There's dry stouts, and there's sweet stouts, and there's milk stouts. And Chris, knowing that you like something a little more on the sweeter side, you know, I'm trying to think of a commercial variety. But I mean, if you're at your local liquor store, you know, you might want to look for those cans or bottles or I guess just ask the clerk that you're looking for a sweet stout or a milk stout.
Okay, because I like Guinness. I mean, I like the basic flavor of Guinness. I just wish it had a little bit more residual sweetness. Not, you know, nothing over the top, but just a little bit to balance the bitterness.
Yeah. Well, Left Hand makes a really nice milk stout. You can get that on Nitro, too, and that's got a good residual sweetness to it. Another one is actually the same company that owns Guinness puts out a brew called Kilkenny that's a little bit sweeter. I think it's also a little bit lighter. It's been a while since I've had one, but that's another one that is in the sweeter realm.
Shoot me an email with those, so because I'll never remember them.
That
you got
that one that I was drinking last week, that bourbon barrel, which the name of it just went south on me here. Ryan, if say it again?
That was Dragon's Milk.
Yeah, that's one.
Yeah, the
Chris,
New Holland.
Yeah, exactly. If you, if you don't mind a slight taste of bourbon, that's a relatively sweet, almost a borderline for me. But you might even enjoy that one too. So, well, again, welcome to the Mead House. What are we drinking tonight? I'll start this one off. I cracked a bottle open of one of my home wines. It's a bottle of Shiraz. And I did something completely whacked out and got, well, not chastised for it on the wine form, but was told that you just don't do that to Shiraz. I actually put some oak on it. apparently, you're not supposed to oak a Shiraz, but you know what? I don't care. I like it. It put a nice mouthfeel in it. I can't believe this. It's only like, I think we just bottled it, what's it been now, 2.5 months ago? And it tastes damn good. You know, it's not hot. It's got a nice mouthfeel. It's got a nice finish to it. It was... it fermented with 14 ounces of fresh blueberries that were sautéed in a sweet red muscadine wine. And, I mean, it's perfect. I love it. So if you like oaked Shiraz, it's very fruit-forward, too. So, apparently you're not supposed to oak Shiraz, Jeff. So let's move on to you. What's in your glass?
Well, I got lazy this week. I didn't get a chance to make it over to the liquor store. And, you know, I took a look before the show at what I had in the cabinet. It was looking pretty bare. So actually, I am drinking a glass of Irish Mist, which is actually Irish whiskey and a little bit of honey. So I'm hitting the hard stuff tonight. And it's
I'll
pretty
buy
good,
that.
It's,
what kind of honey?
Nice and smooth. I don't know. It's the bottle comes with the Irish whiskey and the honey premix.
Oh, okay.
So,
I thought that was something you were mixing yourself. I thought you were doing a little shot of Jameson and a drop of orange blossom.
Nope, that sounds like it's on the right ticket. You know, it's got the sweetness of the honey, and it's got that the just a little bit of bite of that smooth Irish whiskey. So it's nice.
Yeah, sounds good. Ryan, what's in your cup?
I am I'm drinking another beer that my good buddy Christian shipped me. It is a gin barrel aged ale. Yeah, it's a Kolsch, which is my favorite summer beer. I call that a lawnmower beer, aged in gin barrels with juniper berries and ginger added.
Wow.
It is very refreshing and light, and I'm not a huge gin drinker anymore, but this is an amazing beer.
Wow. Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm not much of a Kolsch fan, but the gin addition to that sounds interesting. I would still try that, I think.
Yeah. I've never heard of, I'm not a gin drinker either, so I don't particularly care for anything gin related, but I would give that a shot. Aaron Martin, what are you drinking tonight?
Just a quick comment on the gin. I heard you say, Ryan, you're not a big gin drinker anymore, and it just made me laugh thinking back to the old college days. There was a bar that my friend and I used to go to, and we would always order the same drinks. And it got to the point where the bartender, we would just walk up, and he'd make, I think one was a kamikaze, which is like a lime, some kind of a mixed drink. And then I would always order a gin and tonic, and he would just get to the point where he'd just start making it, wouldn't even ask us what we were having. So that sounds like a fascinating beer. I'll have to see if I can get my hands on some of that.
Yeah.
But anyways, tonight I'm drinking, it's a honey wine, a mead, although on the bottle here it doesn't actually use the word mead. It's from Oliver Winery, and it's a black cherry honey wine. And it's okay. This is my second bottle of Oliver Mead that I've tried before. The first one was just a traditional, and I don't know that these are my favorite meads. This one, it's a little on the sweeter side. I definitely am getting that black cherry flavor coming through, but it's just maybe a little flat and maybe a little too much on the sweet side. Could use a little bit more sharpness in there, but all in all, not terrible.
And Mississippi, is it an Italian roast tonight?
No, I'm breaking the rules tonight because I had a long day.
There you go. What you got?
I've got a one-off batch that I made about a year and a half ago. It was partially planned, and it was partially sort of a clean out the cabinet type thing. And it's unique. I don't know if I would suggest it to everyone or not, but I call it aftershave. And what it is, it's actually a bay rum Acerglen. It's a bay rum Acerglen. It's made with grade B dark maple syrup, a little bit of sorghum molasses, some honey, and some bay leaves.
Oh wow!
And and I think I may have put some brown sugar in this as well. It was, like I said, it was sort of partially planned, partially not, and it's unique. It's not bad. But it's not my favorite. But I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 small beer bottles left, and I figured I would have one tonight.
What? Let's go back to the molasses here for a minute. Do you remember what kind of molasses you used? Is it a blackstrap or
Probably just something from around here locally, just blackstrap molasses. But I don't think I had very much molasses in it because I've never had good luck with putting molasses in anything fermented. So it was probably like a little bit left in the bottom of the jar, and I just threw it in.
Well, yeah, I recall the reason why I ask is because I recall some discussions over on the other show with regarding molasses, and molasses is, you know, if you're going to use it, you got to be very, very careful because it can really whack out the sulfur taste and sulfur aroma.
It can be pretty vile tasting when it's fermented if it's not done correctly, and yeah. I haven't figured out the correct way to do it. I've tried a couple of sizers actually with some molasses in them, and they were awful. I can't remember. I'm not looking at my notes right now, and I don't even know if I made notes on this one. I just remember off the top of my head that I put some molasses in it, but I don't think I put much. I sort of got on a bay rum kick for a while. My wife was making some homemade soaps and lotions and aftershave and things like that, and she made some bay rum, and I really liked it. So I kind of got on this bay rum kick, and every time I smelled it, I could taste it, and it just seemed like something that would taste good. So I said, "Well, let's make a mead out of it." And so I probably just put the molasses in just because I know that rum is made from molasses, and but I think the majority of it actually is the dark grade B maple syrup.
Yeah. And, well, good. Jeff, have you heard anything regarding molasses in your travels making mead?
You know, I've not. I recall hearing bits and snippets, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what it was about. Yeah. You know, I've heard people adding some molasses or some maple syrup or some sorghum syrup and things like that, and it couldn't tell you exactly what that adds to it.
Did the maple, can you get it? Does it have a maple flavor to it at all, Chris? Cause I've heard maple syrup is usually the first thing that ferments all the way out, during fermentation.
Yeah, it's got a definite maple flavor to it. But cool. It's probably because it's a year and a half old.
Yeah.
There's no honey. I can't pick up any honey at all.
Yeah.
That's why I think I probably made up most of the gravity with the maple syrup, probably.
Yeah.
A couple of bay leaves, and I think I may have put one clove in it, one or two cloves. It smells just like bay rum aftershave.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it really does smell like the aftershave, but it's pretty good. It's... on 1 to 10, I would probably put it about it's maybe a 5.
Yeah. Drinkable. All right.
Yeah. I'm drinking.
Good deal. Well, James Purcell over at the Mead Facebook group, I found this little post that he put over there, and I guess he's kind of new at mead making, and he asks, well, I'll read it to you. He says, so to ensure my mead, should I add more honey or sugar during fermentation? Also, to change to a sizer, how much sugar or honey do you add at bottling? Everything I've read just says to add sugar or honey. Says sorry, he's a newbie and wants to try his best to do a good job. And the first thing, I read that twice, and the first thing that came to my mind was, and this is where it pays to know about the yeast. I mean, if you plan it out and select your yeast, you got to know what you're going to do. I think, that's the first thing, because the first sentence, Jeff, he says, so to ensure my meat doesn't come out dry, should I add more honey or sugar during fermentation? So I would think knowing the limitations of your yeast would pretty much tell you, whether or not you're going to have, residual sugars left over or not, depending upon how you had your recipe set up, no?
Absolutely. You need to know your alcohol tolerance of your yeast. And, you know, there are any number of calculators out there that can tell you based on alcohol tolerance and your starting gravity, your final gravity, at what point the gravity is going to, is going to like stop on you.
Now with that, you know, we've all heard stories and experienced how you can shoot a yeast way past its published, alcohol tolerance, or, you know, you might just have some yeast that goes the other way and no matter what you do, it's going to die out at a certain level. I'm personally not a fan of back sweetening. I know he didn't ask this, but what I like to do is I keep 1 gallon jugs around of, mead that is of different sweetnesses, some that are dry, some that are more sweet, that have ended that way. You know, they've either ended dry or they've just ended fermentation with residual sugar. And then if I need something that I need to, you know, dry something out or I need to sweeten something up, I blend in one of those either drier or sweeter meads that I have sitting around. Now, of course, those are stabilized, or else you could reignite fermentation. But that's how I personally like to handle. Now, I agree with Jeff that you should do your calculations up front. I just say that, you know, sometimes you can't count on those because yeast can be a funny creature and go long or stop short.
You are absolutely correct, Ryan, and that is a great best practice to use. You know, he's a first-time mead maker, so I don't want to overcomplicate him more than saying, hey, you know, find a tool online, figure out the alcohol tolerance. You know, I wish I could tell you I had the stock of mead to say, yeah, no, I can sweeten or dry and, you know, adjust and blend. I don't. My stuff gets rank too fast for that.
And you know, in reality, there's very little insurance for your first batch anyway.
True.
You know, that's just the truth. This is one of those, you know, you got to pay your dues kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna mess up a few batches before you figure it out. So
I'll tell the guy this. Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's where keeping notes comes in. Mm-hmm. You make a batch, you keep track of exactly what you put in, and then you taste it. And if it's too dry, you know you need more next time.
Yeah.
And after a few batches, you get it figured out.
Yeah.
The one thing I was going to add is, you know, it's pertinent for today's conversation or this question. I was having lunch with a colleague who said that her husband got into winemaking and quit. He made 2 batches and they weren't very good and he quit. And he started with the cheapest wine kits he could find because he said that, you know, he goes, I'm just starting out, you know, I really don't want to use, use good ingredients when I'm learning or a lot of money, I should say. He didn't say cheap ingredients. He said, I don't want to spend a lot of money when I'm just starting out. I get that. However, you know, quality in, quality out, crap in, crap out.
Yep.
So sort of to James here, you know, yeah, you're right. You know, it's your first time. It's going to be, you know, a learning experience. The biggest key is sanitation, because if it's clean, you know, you can age out most of your flaws. But if you're starting with crap for ingredients, you know, the mellow honey, you know, or something like that. I mean, at least give yourself a shot at a good product by having some decent stuff that you're playing with.
Yeah. Well, and the second part of his, go ahead.
I was just going to add one more thing. Y'all brought up the issue of yeast overshooting their tolerance or stopping too soon or whatever. And everybody that listens on a regular basis, they're going to say, well, here he goes again. But I'm here I go again. temperature control has a lot to do with that. it's certainly not everything, but temperature control has a lot to do with it. If you're having trouble with your yeast constantly overshooting, get that temperature down on the low end of your yeast tolerance range and keep it there. And
I'm gonna cut that piece out where he says low temperature and make a little sound bite out of it. All I gotta do is just hit the button and it'll just play and play and play until I stop it.
I'm gonna go have temperature control tattooed across my back.
Well, that's that's the root to a lot of evils in mead making, wine making as well. Temperature control. So,
it's amazing.
The other part of his statement here, he says to change it to a sizer. I'm not quite sure. Now, he may not understand the styles of mead and what they're all about, because I don't know what he means by change it to a sizer. That would depend on if he started out with apple juice or not, and that we don't know. For all intents and purposes, a sizer, the base, is apple juice.
Yep.
Am I correct? Yeah? I mean, that's kind of where you got to start, and then from there you can use other additions, other juices, different kinds of honey and whatnot. So
yeah, as I read it, it's almost he's using the word sizer, but he almost means carbonating, because how much do I add at bottling?
And that's the third part, Ryan, because that's another area that you've got to be pretty darn careful, because if you toss a bunch of sugar or honey in it during, before you bottle, and then start stuffing that stuff in bottles, cork or no cork, I mean, even bottle caps can only stand so much pressure.
Northern Brewer has a great bottle carbonating calculator, and that's a plug for our friends there. But if you go to it's a free calculator. It's on their website. You plug in your starting gravity, finishing gravity, the level of carbonation that you want, and what you want to use to bottle condition with. And it's got all. It's a great tool to play with. I play with it. And hopefully, you can take a lot of the risk out of bottle bombs.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's a great resource.
Well, James, I hope we helped you out here just a little bit. And I might head you on over to themeadhouse.com. There's a recipe over there. It's an orange blossom recipe. It's very simple. It's a good beginner's recipe. It's solid. It works. Go ahead and give that a try and see what you come up with there. We'd be glad to hear from you, how you did on it too. So, but I hope that helped out a little bit. Talking about, I just wanted to throw this out there. I didn't really want to talk a whole lot about it, but you see where AB InBev has acquired Midwest Supplies and Northern Brewer?
I did see that. There's been a lot of passionate comments around that on some of the forums.
Well, some of these guys, impassioned. I mean, they're very passionate about what they're doing in the craft beer industry. And I've got some passion about it. I mean, I don't drink AB InBev products or Sab Miller Coors anymore, but I'm strictly a craft beer drinker, but I just thought I'd throw that out there. you know, what are we to expect? Who knows? So,
you know, and I, believe me, I'm not an apologist for those mega brewers, but I think sometimes a little bit of context can help. And, you know, the Northern Brewer has been partly owned by a investment group for a while. And it was another investment group, which just happens to be owned by, you know, the Miller Coors or InBev that bought it. I mean, these guys they're in the business of finding investments. They're in the business of, you know, operating companies that make money. I mean, I think that a lot of the passion comes around, what is this going to change is it going to change my store? Is it going to change the company? I'll tell you this, in my experience working with hedge funds and working with, private equity groups, they buy companies that can make money or that are making money, and they try to enhance them, if anything. You know, it's not the, Michael Douglas from Wall Street trying to do the Telstar paper, Blue Star Airlines deal.
Yeah. I think the fear is out there that the next beer kit that you order is going to have a Budweiser emblem on it or something. I don't know. Anyway, I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on that. Just a piece of news that I picked up on. I gave my 2 cents. I mean, I'm not in the habit of giving AB InBev any more than what I absolutely have to, so I'll probably spread my purchases around a little bit. But, you know, last week we talked about this apple juice concentrate thing. We kind of got on that, and I think it was Chris had mentioned that, you know, these cider kits that you can buy from Northern Brewers in various places, they're some form of concentrated apple juice. You get them, and the one kit that he was referring to was, I think it was a 1 gallon kit, if I'm not mistaken, of this concentrated juice. And it, you know, you put it in your fermenter, throw the yeast in, and let it bubble away. Well, I went to the store. We did our weekly shopping, and I thought, well, I'm going to try this. So I brought home the equivalent to about a gallon of apple juice concentrate, frozen apple juice concentrate. And I dumped it all into my 1 gallon or my 2 gallon food container, and put the lid on and let it sit out overnight to thaw out. Well, the next day, I thought, okay, to find out what the gravity of this is. So I plopped the hydrometer in, and it almost bounced out of the bucket. Okay, I mean, it wouldn't even register. I mean, it kept bobbing up and down and tilting back and forth because there wasn't even enough hydrometer in the liquid to even get its own balance. Okay, so I'm guessing somewhere in the 190s to 200 level, maybe. I thought that was kind of funny. And so I immediately texted Chris and I said, hey, this apple juice concentrate, you're not going to believe what it reads on a hydrometer. So,
he sent me a picture of the hydrometer bobbing in the bucket. The bulb on the end was like halfway out of the concentrate.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can't use, do not use, pure apple juice concentrate, you know, if you're going to do it. What I wound up doing is I poured 2 gallons in to make it a 3 gallon batch. I think I wound up, I added 1 pound, actually a little bit more than a pound of brown sugar, rather than honey. Talking with Chris, we decided that maybe that was a route I should go with this thing, just make it a straight cider. And we brought the gravity up to 1.092. And because I wanted this thing to go dry, I'm going to use the SO5 yeast in it. But in fact,
I still think that's a little bit high, to be honest. I think that's
Yeah, and I take that back. Not the SO5. I use Nottingham in it.
Okay.
Yeah. So Nottingham.
That's still a high gravity.
Yeah. I'm hoping it's going to. Well, I'm thinking it's probably going to take it into my realm of likeness. I think it's going to come out, you know, somewhat on the dry side. Not, you know, it's not going to be candy sweet like a candy apple for sure, but, you know, or
so based on your results with the hydrometer, I'm going to make a guess that this apple juice concentrate that's in the cider kit is not fully concentrated. It's probably been diluted down to the proper, concentration.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it may not be all the way to apple juice, but it's certainly been diluted to the proper gravity that they wanted. So that would be my guess. It's just not full concentrate.
Well, and I don't know if there are different kinds of concentrate out there or not, but this may not even be the same kind of concentrate, you know. I don't even know how they, I know that heat is involved somehow. How much heat, I have no idea. I don't have any clue. Jeff, you were going to say something?
I was actually going to say, you know, if you take that all the way to dryness, you're ending up with something pretty heavy as far as alcohol content. You're in the neighborhood of 8 to 9%, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I don't have a calculator in front of me, but.
Yeah, that's fine, and that's fine.
It's more it's more than that, Jeff. 1092s is on upwards of 12%.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
Like I said, I didn't have a calculator in front of me. I know I did.
It's between 10 and 12, I think.
I think it is right about 10 because I did one a few weeks ago at 1090. It was a target alcohol percentage of 10%. So I think you're right on the money. It's 100%.
Yeah, I think I recall seeing 10 on the ABV side of the hydrometer when at that point. So, but and that's fine.
People making those are calling them turbo ciders, so it's not unheard of. It's just God, it's going to be you're not going to drink three or four,
right?
No, no, and that's fine. End result, I'll probably, maybe chuck some oak in it and, might even soak some oak in some bourbon and, chuck those in and see what happens. So, but I just thought it was, I felt the need, since we talked about it last week to pursue this and, lo and behold, apple juice concentrate. I mean, don't even bother. It's not even going to register on your hydrometer. So there you go.
JD, I'm making a bourbon cider, a bourbon oaked cider as well. I've been thinking, about adding a vanilla bean to that, having a vanilla bourbon oaked cider.
Yeah,
and maybe one of us should try it and let the other one know how it turns out.
Yeah, I've got a ton of vanilla beans here. I can chuck one in and and see what it does. I mean, I think if you're going to oak it, I think vanilla, not a lot of vanilla, mind you. I would probably, this is a 3-gallon batch, so one bean is probably more than enough. In fact, I might even cut the bean in half. And start with one. You can always add more vanilla later, but I think it will start with a half of one. And then depending on what kind of oak and what the toast level on the oak is, on top of that. So, but certainly oak and vanilla go together very well. So, one thing. I thought Chris sent a recipe in for the for a blueberry sizer. We're going to talk about that here in just a little bit, but I kind of wanted to get into this a small discussion on placing a value on the convenience of your equipment. Because I, you know, Jeff, or no, I think it was Ryan had sent an email and said that he was looking at a, what was it called? A Catalyst?
Yeah, the Catalyst by Northern Brewer.
Yeah. And, I remember looking at something similar. I think they call it a fast ferment, and it's a kind of a bulbous looking thing, like an upside down teardrop.
Yep.
And at the bottom is this little contraption that you can screw on that actually catches all of the spent yeast and trub and everything that settles out into this other little bulb thing, and you can pull it out, and really you don't even have to rack anything. I mean, you're basically left with fermenting and racking all in the same container. And going through your clearing. So, no racking whatsoever. So I was just wondering, amongst the four of us here, five of us, how much is some of this equipment worth to our convenience? I mean, is this a hobby that we're all willing to invest in, at different levels? I know some, I guess I kind of put it in the email, the difference between a paper airplane and one of these newfangled high-tech radio-controlled airplanes.
Just real quick, I'll tell you, since I have the fast ferment and I use that, the whole pitch of it is that it is an all-in-one system. I mean, you put your ingredients in it, you do your primary, you shut off the valve or you close the valve, you take that bottom container off, you can clean it out, put it back, or you can harvest the yeast from it, put it back, reopen it, now you're in your secondary fermentation, close it again, replace it. Instead of putting the valve there, you replace it with a hose, your bottling hose, and you can bottle directly from it. So I mean, it's an all-in-one fermentation device, all the way from primary to bottle. I said I've had some issues with mine. I love the idea. I think that because it's made out of plastic, it's had some issues. And while I have seen the stainless steel conical fermenters. They also say that the conical shape of it, it shortens the primary fermentation time. It's supposed to create some kind of vortex that ferments a little quicker. Fast ferment. Right?
Yeah.
I have not seen even my neighbor has got a conical stainless steel one, but the difference is, he can't bottle from his. I don't know if you can bottle from yours, JD, but it's that it replaces your primary, your secondary, and your bottling bucket, so that you save yourself from all the rackings, all the cleanings, and any risk of exposure to oxidation again if it were working correctly.
Yeah. No, I can't bottle from mine, although it does have a cone shape. I don't know that I would call it a conical. It's not a full conical like you see with some of the Blickman and even some of the Brewtech stuff out there. But it does have a valve on it that you can use to rack with. And you just simply turn the valve so that the little stainless steel tube on the inside is now facing upright instead of down during fermentation. You turn it till it faces upright, and then it will, you can outflow the fermenter without picking up the trub and spent yeast and leaves at the bottom. So that's, I guess, an advantage. But we're talking about, if you're going to get involved in this hobby, I mean, how far do you want to go? Because I know that you can get plumb buried in this. I mean, I've probably got, maybe close to maybe $1,500, if that, you know, maybe $1,600 invested in my setup.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, I know you, mm-hmm. and I know that you're the cheapest guy on the planet.
I still have my lunch money from the second grade.
So what is your equipment worth to you? And is there any investment opportunities for you? I mean, is this a hobby that you want to invest further in, or are you satisfied where you're at?
I am perfectly satisfied where I'm at, because it's no secret I'm a miser, and I'm using food grade plastic buckets that you can get from Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's, food grade plastic trash cans if it's a big batch. And I'm making mead that I like, that my family and friends like. And quite frankly, I believe some of them could win awards. I have no reason to step up to anything else. I have no reason to look for other methods. They're readily available. They're cheap. They're easy to clean. And I would probably, if I had to look at my entire mead making setup, all the equipment and everything together, carboys and all, probably $200 at the most. So, and I'm making good mead. So, I just don't have any, motive to step up to anything else. I'm perfectly happy with it.
Yeah, so the paper airplane works for you.
Works for me good, and sails far.
Yeah. Aaron, what's your take on all this? I mean, is this something that you're willing to invest in, spend the money, or are you, like Chris, are you satisfied with what you got, or do you have a desire to see it to another level?
It's a good question. I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I will say the setup that I have now, I'm perfectly satisfied with, but I'm also in a climate and an environment where I can kind of get away with it. So my setup is pretty simple. I ferment both primary and secondary in glass carboys. I don't have a kegging system. I bottle everything. And like I was alluding to earlier, I live in a climate where down in the basement, especially in the winter months, you know, it's 63, 64 degrees down there, which is right in the zone of where I want to be fermenting. With all that being said, I do think that I am definitely interested in kind of enhancing my setup and looking at some new different things I can add on, probably a more sophisticated temperature control setup is something that would probably be first on my list. I think for me, it's more about prioritizing, you know, looking at things like kegging systems, temperature control systems, you know, different types of fermenters, whether that's stainless steel or the Catalyst, I think it was called, which looks like a pretty neat setup as well. You know, these are all things that kind of perk my interest and are all things that I would be interested in pursuing at some point. It's just a matter of what's the highest priority and when is the right time to make the move on that. But I think for right now, I'm probably in a good place with the setup that I have.
Yeah. And Jeff, I'm a big fan of the homebrewtalk.com, and I love looking at the pictures of some of these, I guess they call them brew sculptures that these guys have. I mean, these mountainous looking contraptions with kettles and stainless steel and all of that. And it's in a guy's garage. You know, I mean, it looks like a $10,000, you know, for what? For a couple of cases of craft beer on a weekend, you know?
I look at setups like that and go, man, I'm glad I'm a mead maker and don't boil much.
What's your where are you at with all this? I know you've been working on a refrigerator for a fermenter, you know, temperature control wise. But you know, as far as upgrading or taking, you know, where is it that you want to be with your equipment? And are you willing to spend you know, the money to get there, or are you like Chris, perfectly satisfied with the Walmart product, the Lowe's product, the buckets here and there, trash cans? You know,
I would say, if anything, I'm kind of in line with Aaron here. When it comes to investing in gear, I'm not opposed to spending a little money to get up there, but I'm looking for bang for buck. I want to make sure that, you know, what I'm doing is going to be a good, a benefit to me. So, like, you know, the fridge that I found for cheap that I'm slowly converting up to the temperature control, that's a small investment, a lot of time. And I'm perfectly happy to do that, because that will ultimately get me better mead. And, you know, for the amount of my free time that I'm spending, you know, basically just tackling a puzzle in my mind, this is a perfectly acceptable trade-off.
Yeah.
When it comes to stuff like the fast ferment or the catalyst, I'm reticent to be an early adopter. This is going to make me sound like I'm several decades older than I am. But you know, newfangled fishy stuff. It looks like it could go either way. It could be really useful. It could be a new, innovative way to do things, or it could be a gimmick that's going to prove to be, you know, kind of not worth my time. And it sounds like with the threading issue on those fast ferments, yeah, they've got some kinks to work out. So, you know, I'm not saying I don't jump on to new trends, but I want to get a couple generations in to let them figure out some of the flaws of the first run before I jump in on that and spend my money there.
Yeah.
Can I add something to this in addition to what I said earlier? I based my opinion on this on the quality of mead that I'm producing. And that's what I think everyone should do. So if you have the capabilities to produce what you like, then you're where you need to be. If you're lacking something, then that's where you need to be spending your money. So yeah, sort of like Aaron said, prioritizing your purchases. What can you buy? If you're going to buy something, what can you purchase that's going to improve your quality? And if you're just wanting to buy some gadget, that's not necessarily going to improve your mead making, that's fine too, if that's what you want to do, if you really enjoy the hobby that much. But, you know, I'm not opposed at all to spending money to improve the quality. But I'm at a point right now where I don't think I have any more knowledge, as far as mead making goes. I don't think that there's a gadget that's going to help me make better mead. I think the only thing that's going to help me make better mead is just simply more experience. And if sometime in the future that I come across something that I do think will help, I'm certainly not opposed to getting it.
Yeah, Chris.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Just going to say, I think you raise a good point, and it's helping me kind of expand some of the thoughts that I'm having on this subject. It's, you know, quality is definitely one thing, and just one other factor that I think plays into it as well is just your own efficiency as well. You know, earlier Ryan was talking about that catalyst as being a fermenter that is both the primary, it's the secondary, and it's also your bottling bucket. So, you know, you think of all of the time that you spend cleaning and sanitizing different fermentation vessels and racking and transferring the mead from vessel to vessel, you know, with that setup, now you're cutting all of that time out as well. So efficiency may be another factor in addition to the quality when going to prioritize. Now, I think I'm in line with you that if I was prioritizing my purchases, I'd probably start with the things that are going to help me make better mead and improve the quality of my mead before I move to something that's going to help me do it faster. Just because it, you know, for me, it's a hobby. The time that I spend making mead or, you know, racking and things like that. It's enjoyable time for me. It's a way I like to spend my free time. So, you know, speeding that up isn't something that's real high on my priority list.
Exactly. Just like an automatic stirrer, you know, the time that I spend making mead and tending to it is sort of downtime for me. It's relaxing. I enjoy starting a batch of mead and going in there every day, checking the gravity, stirring it, degassing it, putting in the nutrients. You know, I could buy a fermenter with an automatic stirrer where it stirred constantly, and all I would have to do is basically dump it in and push a button and forget about it. But that takes all the enjoyment away from it. I'm sort of a hands-on person. I enjoy doing things, so I'm not really looking to shortcut and save time, but I will definitely spend money on something that will improve the quality of it.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I mean, that's, you know, you know, my take on this whole thing is I jumped into this thing with both feet, and after the first couple of failed, well, I wouldn't even call the first one a real failure. I mean, it's over 2 years old and it's starting to come around finally, but I learned a lot of lessons early, and that's when I went in search of equipment. What are we really, you know, what do I need to do to really accomplish what I need to accomplish? And I wasn't, you know, I could care less about competitions, or any of that. I just wanted to, like Chris, make, you know, good mead. And, so I looked at different recommendations, and I chose to go the stainless steel route, and bought one, really liked it, bought a second one. They gave me a little more versatility. I could have gone, you know, there are a reasonable amount that I'm willing to invest, but there's not an overly whacked out amount that I'm gonna spend, because I could have gone out and bought one of these glycol systems, but that's $5,000, you know.
So you're obsessed with stainless steel, JD.
Well, because it's clean. It's a vessel that has an internal chilling system. Nothing else plastic has anything.
If they ever start making those love dolls out of stainless steel, you're going to end up divorced. Because everything you've been buying is stainless steel.
Stainless steel. Well, because, you know, it's clean. I like it. And almost got into a third fermenter, you know, to use strictly for beer. And, of course, that was the tough one to have to try to run by the wife. And she says, well, just how much beer do you think we can drink? So I got to figure out another angle, but I don't know that I even really need it, you know, to be honest with you. I mean, it's one of those things that you hope for that would appear underneath a Christmas tree at Christmas time. But
And JD said the famous last words of a redneck is, watch this.
Watch this. But, you know, I mean, I've got a nice system. It works. I invested, you know, a few bucks into it, and it works for me. So I think Chris really said a mouthful there. I mean, you know, I think you're going to spend as much as you think you need to spend to make good mead, and you really don't have to spend any more. And if you're happy with your equipment, go for it. But if you're the kind of person that, you know, thinks that, you know, it would be easier and convenience, sometimes get in the way to go out and spend the money to, like I did. I mean, a lot of this is convenience, for me. The way my little brew wall is set up, I like it. It works. And I'm happy with it. So,
but big boy toys are fun.
Yeah.
I just have big boy toys for other hobbies other than mead making. So, if you want your big boy toys for mead making, go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would just throw out the caveat there that, you know, you when you're looking at investing in stuff, make sure that you're investing in stuff for your enjoyment, for the convenience of it. Don't let yourself fall into the trap that thinking, you know, if I buy this stainless steel fermenter, my meat is going to be so much better for it. It might be a little bit better for it, but you know, don't let yourself fall into the trap of, oh, I can just, you know, get better stuff by getting better equipment. Make better meat first, and then.
Well, I'm sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
That was the end of my thought. You know,
I was going to say now what this can do is it can help you along your journey, and I'll say two things on that. The one is if oxidation is an issue, this, you know, when you're transferring, this can eliminate, you know, that or help eliminate that exposure to oxygen. Now, number two is if you have trouble racking, if you're not used to how to do it, or if you're not an expert at it yet, and you don't have a good racking cane and you tend to suck up some sediment, this can help you with that as well. So, I mean, it can give somebody the tools who may not have the best practices yet to eliminate oxidation and eliminate sediment. Now, with that being said, I think that for about a quarter of the price, you could do your primary fermentation in a bottling bucket, run the tube into a carboy, probably a plastic carboy that's also got a spigot on it, and you could primary ferment your bottling bucket, secondary ferment in your plastic carboy with a spigot on it, and then just bottle it right out of there.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing too is you go to Craigslist out here where I'm at and type in beer equipment or beer making equipment, craft beer equipment, and you'd be surprised how many of those brew sculptures, Jeff, that are up for sale, which kind of makes you wonder what happened.
I tend to lurk on some local homebrewing clubs near me that I've my problem with homebrewing clubs is not that that I don't like being a part of a group, but you know, I have a hard time making it to meetings and being consistent with a monthly schedule, and I've gone to a couple to check them out and I've just never stuck with one, but I've joined their Facebook groups and I see messages from them. And what I see happening a lot is people will get an elaborate gas setup, and they'll go, yeah, this is a lot of stuff. It takes up a lot of space in my garage. It's a big hassle on brew day, and I'm taking it all day. I'm just going to downsize to an electric brew in the bag system, and I'm just going to get rid of all this other gas stuff.
Exactly.
I think everyone finds their medium when it comes to the amount of space they want, the amount of complication they want in their setup, and what they want to do with it. I mean, you're probably accomplishing more with a gas powered system and like multiple mash tuns and kettle and all that than you are with a single kettle brew in the bag system. But if you're getting what you want out of a simpler setup, there's nothing wrong with going simpler either.
Yeah. Well, spend whatever you want to make you happy, I guess. As far as the, your equipment. And don't forget the DIY stuff too. I mean, we've turned a couple of shows out on several projects, if I could go down Chris's road, the whole temperature thing, we came up with an idea. Chris is using a pretty hefty cooler system like I'm using, and it works. And it works for me, and it's convenient, plus it's efficient. And
I made a big mistake a moment ago. I said all my equipment together was probably couple hundred bucks. I forgot about the cooling system. I think I tried to subconsciously put that purchase out of my mind.
Let's say 500 bucks, right?
More than that.
I know what that cooler costs.
it was big time. It hurt my feelings.
Well, yeah, but the nice thing is, you know, I've got two fermenters running. I don't have anything else running off the cooling system, just the two fermenters, and I'm putting my block ice that I make at home into my cooler, and I do that once every 6 days, okay? And the water temperature never goes above 45 degrees in the cooler, never. So in 6 days, I don't mind. In fact, I make so damn much block ice now that I have to stop. I've got, you know, my little freezer will only hold two of the containers plus three of the blocks after they come out of the containers. So then that's all I can stuff in there. So, you know, so you talk convenience versus expense. Before I was having to make ice every other day and it was a pain. But now that I've got, you know, I spent the money, $300 cooler, 6 days, you know, and it runs two of the fermenters. So,
yeah, I've put two batches of mead through this cooling system so far, because I've been so busy. I just haven't had time to make a lot of mead lately. And, throughout the entire primary fermentation on both batches, I put one block of ice in the Yeti.
Yeah.
Other than what I put in the beginning, I had to put ice in once through the entire primary. So,
right.
I guess I'm getting my money's worth, but it was a lot of money.
You know, it's, well, like I said, it goes back to the beginning of the conversation. You know, what I mean, what's it worth to you, and how much do you want to spend on it, and how serious of a hobby is it really for you? And because that's all stuff that you need to figure out on your own. Moving on, let's get an update on where we're at with our braggots and sizers. Mine has almost. I get a bubble about once every 10 minutes of that now. This is that bourbon barrel beer kit, remember. We put 6.5 pounds of wildflower honey on top of everything else that came in the kit. And we're just going to go see what happens. But it's in the final stages of primary fermentation. Probably going to give it about maybe 6 or 7 more days, maybe a week and a half. Before we see where we're at on the hydrometer and take it into secondary. And when I get it there, it'll go on some oak and some bourbon, maybe even a vanilla bean or two to see where, see what we come out with. So that's where my braggot's at. Chris, did your kit come in?
Yep, I'm 4 days into primary right now. I did the degassing this morning, and I'll probably do the final nutrient addition tonight after we get finished with the show. And it's been cool enough here, I don't even have this batch in my cooling system. I just set it to the side, and it's going to town. So I'm looking for the probably going to be just a tad bit past the 1/3 sugar break tonight, so it'll get the final nutrients, and that'll be it.
Yeah. Ryan, where you're at with yours?
Mine's 10 days in primary. It's going to go to secondary this week sometime, just when I get the time. I've actually got to clean out. All my carboys are full. I've got 2 5-gallon carboys that are about the same, or that are the same wine. And I'm going to move those into I've got a 10-gallon Demijohn. So I got a little work ahead of me. I got to move those two, got to clean out the Demijohn, move the 2 5-gallon carboys into the 10-gallon Demijohn, then clean out those 5 gallons so I can rack the braggot into one of the 5-gallon carboys, where it's going to sit on a vanilla bean and 8 ounces of toasted coconut, And in case you're wondering why it's going to be 8 ounces of toasted coconut, it's because that's how big the package was at Whole Foods.
Is 8 ounces going to be enough, do you think?
I think it is. I'm not trying to make a coconut braggot. I'm trying to make a braggot that's got a little bit of coconut essence to it. Yeah. So I do feel that that 8 ounces is going to do it.
Well, that's, you know, coconut being as light as it is, it's still a lot of coconut.
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. Jeff, what's up with the braggot? Did we lose Jeff?
I'm here. Mine is clear into secondary. I am, it's been about 6 weeks now since I started it, and it has, it's cleared, looks and tastes fantastic. I think when I submitted this recipe weeks and weeks ago, I gave like a laundry list of stuff we could do with it once it got to secondary, and I'm tasting it, and I'm finding, you know, we really don't need to do much of anything at all with it. It has, a lot of the yeast character that I was looking for. It has that kind of a prototypical spiciness you get from the Saison. There's a little bit of that, I don't know, bitterness or acidity from the basswood honey that I used that came out really nicely and actually paired really well with this. So at this point, I'm just going to get some bottles together, use a priming calculator to figure out how much more honey I want to add to this to get some carbonation on it. And get that bottled up.
Wow, sounds good. And it's Aaron's fault that we're going down this whole braggot road to begin with. You know, had he not sent me that one bottle of braggot, you know, we probably would have been doing something else. But dude, that stuff was so good. What's up with the braggot project in your house?
So for me, the black IPA style braggot, I've got the recipe down. Just got some things going on in life right now that are keeping me from starting any new batches maybe for the next couple of months here. But I think this is one of the things I've kind of got a queue of things that when I'm able to get back into it, this is going to be near the top, if not at the top, is the black IPA braggot. But the recipe, I think, is finalized, and I'll be ready to hit this one hard.
Yeah, cool. Actually, Jeff took a question from Scott to that here in just a little bit. But first, I wanted Chris to talk about this. Man, I got to try this too. This sounds so good. This blueberry sizer recipe, and I'm going to go ahead and throw it up on the website later on tonight too. But Chris, to us about
before
this.
Before you put it up, I've got a couple of refinements I need to make there.
Okay.
And mostly in measurements and things.
All right.
This is entirely credited to Pete Bakalich, who really made he was on a sizer kick, and he may still be, I don't know. But I found this on an internet search that Pete had posted somewhere, and he had originally posted it for a 6 gallon yield, and I decided to scale it down for a 1 gallon so that more people might be willing to try it. And it uses a couple of unique techniques, actually. One is to let it sit on the fruit skins and on the trub for about a month, 6 weeks, actually, I think. And then it also uses lees aging in secondary. And so that was two techniques that I don't think we've really talked that much about or covered.
Right.
So the benefit that you're going to get from letting this sit on the berries for a while is you're going to get more color extraction. You're going to get some of the fine grain tannin extraction from the berries that you might not get just in primary. And then the lees aging will add a lot of mouthfeel and body to it, and really change the character of the whole thing. So it gives you an exercise in doing some things that we haven't talked about much, and also an exercise in patience. Because we're going to be doing lees aging, this is one of the few times you'll ever hear me say this, but do not use 71B yeast on this. D47 and D21 are my choices. DV10 will work, but it'll take it a little drier than the other two will. I like this to finish somewhere in the 10-20 range. It helps to balance the acidity and tartness real well in this without being overly sweet. But it just gives you the blueberries just sort of make up for what the apples that we have available to us in the U.S. Are lacking. And by letting it sit on the berries, it you'll get even some of the bitterness from the seeds and the skins, which is making up for the lack of bitter apples that we have. And it's not overly blueberry, really. But it is definitely a blueberry flavor there. It's going to take a little more aging than what we normally talk about on this show, but nothing excessive. And I think everybody should give it a try. And, you know, it's not really a difficult process. It's just something that you have to sort of keep an eye on.
Yeah.
The changes, if you want to write these down, JD, yeah. The changes, in the email, I said 2.5 pounds of blueberries. That should be 2.75 pounds of blueberries.
Okay.
I think I forgot to mention that to put the pectic enzyme in, but it was listed. So
yeah,
I don't think I put it in the – yeah, but I didn't say it goes right in primary. And and then the other thing that I left out on the email was after you get this off the lees aging into tertiary, it would be a good idea maybe to put some brandy-soaked oak cubes on it for a couple of months.
Wow.
And if you're buying the cubes, I would probably use for 1 gallon. I probably wouldn't use but about 3 or 4 of the medium toast American oak. You can soak those for a few days in some brandy if you want.
Three or four. You're not talking 3 or 4 ounces. That's enough for 5 gallons. You're talking just
3 or 4 cubes.
3 or 4 cubes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably no more than about 4 cubes for a gallon.
Yeah.
Since it's such a small amount. And you can soak those in a little bit of brandy for a few days beforehand. And let it sit on there a couple of months.
Yeah.
Make a really good sizer.
I think it'd be
a good attempt for anyone who's been listening. Should be pretty familiar with all the other details. I didn't give specific amounts on the nutrients because I did that email in a hurry. But you can use the Tosna calculator and figure all that out.
Yeah. So basically the ingredients are 1 can of frozen apple juice concentrate, 1 gallon of apple juice, 2.75 or 2 3/4 pounds frozen blueberries. I suppose the same in fresh if you can get them. Honey, the amount to be determined. Now we're looking for the honey to take you to 1.130 if I read this right.
Yeah, it's going to be a balancing act. You're going to start out with about 3 quarts of the juice and your concentrate and put in some honey. And you just want to get it to the point where you're at about a starting gravity of 1130. And, you know, you want to be somewhere around 1.5 gallons total volume. So to account for racking losses. So,
yeah.
You just sort of have to balance it back and forth. Add a little honey, add a little juice until you get to that gravity at that volume.
Would you, another thing too, with the lalazyme and or pectic enzyme addition and the Camden tablet, I would probably let that sit on those two for, what, a couple of days before I...
Well, in this case, you really don't have to, because we're going to let it sit in primary for about 6 weeks.
Okay.
So there's really no need to do it beforehand.
All right.
It's all, everything's going to stay in the primary bucket undisturbed after primary is over for about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's okay. Going to have plenty of time to do its thing.
Excellent. Man, that sounds really good. And it just so happens that I've got 2 1-gallon containers of apple juice and an empty 2-gallon food container here. So I just don't have any blueberries.
And the apple juice concentrate, that's just to boost the apple flavor in it more sure. than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this sounds really good, Chris, and I'll make the changes on the recipe. I tell you what I'll do is I'll make the changes on the recipe, shoot you an email. You can verify it, and then we'll put it up on the website. If anybody okay. wants to give this a shot, but man, this really sounds
yeah,
good.
Yeah, we need to give credit to Pete Bakalich for the sure. original recipe, because it did the inspiration came from him on this.
Yeah. Yeah, I can do that. No problem. Jeff, you had, it was either Jeff or Ryan. I think the email came from Jeff, as I remember. Scott Monroe, he's an avid listener to the show.
He is.
Man, the guy really pays attention, too, because I'll get notices on Facebook that, he's doing something or tried something that, we had mentioned on the show, so... he's probably one of our biggest fans out there, but you fielded a question from him about. Well, I'll let you take it from here.
Well, sure. We were talking about his the kit that he'd put together for his Braggot this morning, and I thought it would be an interesting question to post to the group and kind of just get everybody's thoughts on, because part of the beer brewing process is doing a boil to get the sugars dissolved and get the alpha acids out of your hops, this, that, and the other. And he was a little bit worried that his boiling was a little bit more aggressive than it should have been, because he ended up with slightly less than a gallon in his batch size there. He ended up with, I want to say it was 3/4 of a gallon and change. He asked me if he should worry about that, if he should add some more water to the fermenter. I assume he was working with a kit, and that the kit kind of had a pre-measured amount of significant gravity or pre-measured amount of ingredients that it was going for. So adding water to that was probably a good idea. And he asked if he should boil it first. And it occurred to me that, there may be, parasites or things in there that could potentially take over. The chances are slim, but, it wouldn't hurt to be prudent about that. And the simpler solution, though, rather than boiling it and risking stripping oxygen out of the water, would be to basically like pasteurize it, hold it above 150 degrees Fahrenheit for something like 20 or 30 minutes, so that you kill anything that's going to try and outcompete that yeast before you add it in there. And of course, before you add it in there, you also have to take it below 10 degrees. I'm sorry, within 10 degrees of the temperature of the muster forbidding you're fermenting at, to make sure you're not shocking the yeast either.
So I
kind of thought I'd throw that out there and see what you guys thought about that. If that's too much effort, just throw some water in, call it good, or if you would just forego it and make a little bit stronger drink. So what do you guys think?
I think, if he's working with a beer kit, like when I do mine, I put 2.5 gallons in. That's my starting amount. But what I wind up with is far less than that, maybe 2 gallons. And but of course, when it goes into the fermenter, I'm topping up with water to the 5 gallon mark. And it's just, I'm, you know, just using regular spring water. Ryan, what do you, how would you treat?
When I add the additional water, I'm using stuff out of my Brita water pitcher. I'm not overly concerned about, going into primary. I mean, if there's nutrients in there, or even if there's any kind of microorganisms, I mean, let's go back to thousands of years ago of why, you know, why the Last Supper was bread and wine. And it's because the water wasn't safe to drink, but once they started fermenting things, it becomes safe to drink. So, I feel like as long as you've got a decent water, you're going to be just fine, you know, going into your primary fermentation.
Yeah.
Well, and that's another good point, if I can interject there. The Brita filter also does one nice thing if you're using tap water, because if there's chloramines or chlorine in your water, and the yeast get to act on that, you can end up with some nasty, like the plasticky or the used Band-Aid kind of taste from the way those interact together.
Oh, yeah. That's sick. Wow. Okay. Aaron, have you got anything to add at all? Or?
Not really. I think, JD, the method that you described that you use in terms of topping up just with spring water up to the 5 gallon mark, that's pretty much what I do as well.
Yeah. I don't have a vessel. In fact, at your kitchen stove, you're going to have a hell of a time trying to boil 5 gallons of liquid on your kitchen stove anyway, because there's just not enough BTUs there to, you might get a bubble or two off the bottom, but you're not going to get a standing rolling boil like what's required. So, and I don't know. I mean, I don't see, I'm assuming this is a 1 gallon kit, do you think, Jeff,
That was the impression that I got from him, but let me check that out. I want to say it was a 1 gallon. He's saying he lost about 0.3 to 0.4 gallons during the boil. So he started with more than a gallon, about a gallon and a quarter, and just lost a little bit more than he was expecting to.
Yeah, Scott, if you're listening, bud, PM me real quick on Facebook. I've got it open, and just with a number, tell me 1-5 as to the size of your project there. But
Scott now. He's saying 1 gallon.
Okay, good, perfect. Okay, all right. So I'm with Ryan. I really don't see the point in boiling the water. If you've got good clean water where you live, if that's what you typically use in your mead making and beer making, then, you know, just go ahead and add that to your fermenter. You'd be fine. If you're unsure, like where I live, I mean, they put so much crap in the water out here. I use store-bought spring water. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I use store-bought spring water for everything that I make. And I've actually, I think I've said this before, I've heard people who avoided sanitizers that you have to rinse because they said, well, if you rinse them, then you're putting water, you know, it's going to ruin your sanitization. But the water that you're using is good enough to put in your meat or beer without boiling it. So if it's good enough to make the mead with, it should be okay to rinse your fermenter with. I don't see a problem there. So,
right. Well, and the other sorry to cut you off.
No, that's fine.
Well, the other thing that I'd thought about, you know, after the fact here was, well, the whole point of the no boil method with mead is that honey is naturally antimicrobial. And granted, he's got other things besides honey into this must. Now, it's a it's a braggart. So, but we're also bumping that significant gravity up pretty high to where it may not even be hospitable to it. Or you know, if it's a braggart and you know, we're doing this right, the majority of the fermentable sugars are coming from honey anyway. Does that make it even less, you know, necessary to treat that water or to heat that water up and kill things beforehand?
Yeah.
Yeah, but no yeah. matter how much sanitization you do or how much boiling, once you cool that water down to room temperature or brewing temperature, there's so many microbes in the air that you've just introduced billions more into it before you ever start fermenting. We live in a world dominated by microbes. They're everywhere. We're never going to get rid of them. And so I think people really get overly obsessed with this issue of sanitization and things when it's really, it's futile because you can't get away from it. Lucky for us, there's just not enough of the bad things floating around that it occurs frequently. But, you know, it can occur, sure, but I just wouldn't stress over it that much.
Yeah, and if you don't, you know, if you doubt what Chris is talking about, the microbes, just check with your wife when she dusts all the, you know, goes through the house and does all the dusting and vacuuming. I do that at my house on a weekly basis because we have to. I live about a quarter of a mile from the 405 freeway, and we get so much dust it's not even funny. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, that's why I can't, that's why I'm such a, you know, I'm not so much now, but when I first started this thing, and Chris kind of tested this one of the first shows that I did over at God Mead, I mean, my kitchen looked like a damn operating room. I mean, I sanitized everything, the countertops, the floor, the walls, I mean, everything. I was just so scared that something was going to get into my mead and, you know, make people sick, my relatives and whatnot. But, you know, come to find out that I didn't need to be that anal about it. But, I was just a clean freak about this because I knew other people besides me were going to drink it. So, anyway, guys, that pretty much wraps the show for tonight.
I got if I can.
I see Ryan's hand going up.
if I can jump in, I've got to give one quick shout out, and then I got one question. I'll make it real quick for the group. My brother, who lives in Omaha, Jesse, got me a nice jar of watermelon blossom honey.
Oh, wow.
He knows that I, you know, he's helped me make mead. He likes drinking it, that kind of thing. Quick question for the group. It's a small jar. It's a 1.5-pound jar. I'm going to use it in a 1-gallon batch, which should be just fine for my session strength stuff. Quick poll. Should I make a traditional out of it, or should I juice a watermelon and go watermelon water on top of watermelon honey?
No.
What do you guys think?
Traditional.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I want to know what that stuff tastes like.
Yep.
Pretty much.
Yeah, because I've never even heard of it.
Yep.
Unanimous.
Well, that was a quick pull. Traditional it is. I'm going to do I'll use a nice clean yeast, and we'll have, my guess is that's going to settle in at about 7.5% ABV, and which will be great session strength, and let it I'll let it sit for a little while to bring back some of that honey flavor, and we'll go with it.
Yeah, I definitely would be curious as to take accurate, detailed notes, because I want to know what that stuff tasted like in the end. So, you know, whether you actually get any watermelon. Hey, I mean, I'm looking for that kind of stuff out of all these whacked out honeys that I get here, too. I mean, you know, the blackberry, for crying out loud. I put blackberry honey in the hibiscus project that I did using Jeff's recipe Now, I can't tell you. It's about ready to bottle, Jeff. And as soon as I get into the bottle, I'll send you one. But I have no clue as to what this might have contributed to the hibiscus. It damn sure didn't taste like blackberries to me. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that. But I'd be curious.
Yeah, and Ryan, if I had 1.5 pounds of that honey, I think I would forego the session strength, and I would probably just make whatever it will make in a full strength mead, just so that I can get the full flavor of it and see what it's like. Yeah. I mean, even if you only come out with, you know, a quart of mead, just that's what I would do.
Yeah, it's probably enough to do start with a half gallon, in primary, and then go down from there.
Yeah.
I would probably just get whatever I could get out of it at full strength, just so that I could evaluate it.
That sounds like a plan.
Well, thanks for the input, guys. I appreciate it.
So, all right. Well, that's going to wrap the show here tonight. I don't even know how far we are into this thing. I don't even know what week we're on, but typically we do 6 and 2. I'll have to check the calendar and see where we're at. I know we're coming into the holidays here pretty soon, but always a blast here with the crew. You can look for us again on themeadhouse.com. The replays are always available there. They're on iTunes. They're on Stitcher. Gosh, we just get them spread out all over the place. We're over 4,000 downloads, guys. So we've got quite a few people listening after the fact. But I know Scott Monroe, I know you're always out there live. So with that, hey, what do you say we all get together next Tuesday night? Do it again. We'll see you.